And Al was on stage at Leicester Jongleurs, and somebody got a champagne bottle, right, and shot it at him, and the cork just whizzed past him.
Welcome to the Elektra Podcast. My name is Wouter Monde. I am a comedian from the Netherlands, and in this podcast, I talk to my fellow comedians about their worst and weirdest gigs. Usually, my guests are from Holland or Belgium, but in this episode, I'll be talking to Russell Howard, a comedian who's famous all over the world. Russell started performing in 1999 when he was very young, and quickly grew out to be one of the most successful comics in the UK. He sells out venues like the Hammersmith Apollo and Wembley Stadium. He did a run of 10 sold-out shows at the Royal Albert Hall, and he tours arenas and theatres worldwide. And on top of that, he's written for and hosted TV shows such as Russell Howard's Good News Show, and he has been a guest on too many other shows to mention. Russell is going on a brand new world tour starting the 5th of February, taking him all over Europe, Asia and America. And he will be back in the Netherlands to do 3 shows in February, one in Rotterdam and 2 in Amsterdam. You'll find a link in the description of this episode to get your tickets. And I will also include links to previous episodes I've done in English. Please enjoy the Elektra Podcast with Russell Howard. You have played in Holland before, have you?
Oh. Yes, I've done 2 gigs, I think 3 gigs in Amsterdam and 2 in Rotterdam.
Okay.
And they were great, they were fun.
Okay, because usually, well, not usually, that's not the right word, but... the Dutch are said
you have a reputation. Let's not run. Yeah, yeah. What's fantastic about that is it goes worldwide. So it's like, it's very much that thing of, that was humorous, here are my teeth. But the first time you do it, it's really exhilarating because you're like, oh, is this going okay? And then at the end, the audience go absolutely ballistic. But that was my first ever show. And I was like going, oh my God, this is not going great. And then at the end they went, and clearly it was because they were trying so hard to concentrate listening to me in one of their many languages.
But is that it? Because if you perform in Germany or France or whatever,
but
you also have to do the translating.
Yeah, but I would say it only happened the first time, and then the other gigs that I did subsequently, they were just great. They were just, you know, out for a laugh. But I think I think also Dutch people enjoy the reputation that they're a tough nut to crack. Do you know what I mean? They kind of...
Yeah, I guess they do, because they can be like that in Holland as well.
Oh, really?
You know, with their arms folded in front of their chest.
Yeah, well, that's it. I saw 5 minutes into my second gig in Holland where I saw a man let his tits hang free and I thought, well, this is going to be great. Do you know what I mean? I was really happy. It's funny. Like New Zealand has a similar reputation that they're very much kind of like that. And then they just gradually thaw out. It feels like you're doing a gig to 1,000 dads and mums. Do you know what I mean? That kind of secretly wanted you adopted. That kind of weird... Do you know what I mean? You feel like you're 8 years old and you're trying to stay up late. But no, that was only the first show. But then after that, they were great, really. You know,
Were you warned by people?
Everyone, like fellow comics, promoters, the promoters of the show, you know, and it was just, and you're like, ah, be fine. And it's just a slightly different vibe. But... like I say, that was only the first gig, and then the others were all right. I think because they were bigger, maybe. Because the last time I did, did an arena, and it was kind of, you know, you'd have to be pretty bad to die in an arena. Do you know what I mean? It's just like there's so many people there that even if you get a few of them laughing. But I think this time we're doing in Amsterdam sort of an 1800, so it's kind of just right, just the right kind of.
Yeah, you're doing Rotterdam, which is, I think, 16 or 1700. And it's a lovely big room. Mm. And the one in Amsterdam is possibly the prettiest and most loveliest theatre we have.
Yeah, well, that's what everyone said. It was just like, oh, that's the room to play. So, you know, I was like, oh, great. So, yeah, that's what we're doing. I'm looking forward to it.
Should be fun. That's in next month. So that's between January and March. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the word right.
Yeah.
February.
I mean, literally, as I'm trying to promote myself, why don't I actually say when it is? It is the 20th of February and the 21st of February at the Royal Theatre Carré. Now I don't know whether you're fucking with me now.
Because I'm not fucking with you.
If I go to walk on stage, no, it's the Carré. I don't know about that. Imagine if I mispronounce it and they go from that to that just because I fuck it. I'm straight.
No, you're doing Carré. Carré. And you're doing Rotterdam as well on the 19th. Right.
Yeah, and something
that, that's a tougher name because that's Nieuwe Luxor.
Yeah, I've just got Luxor, so I'll just say, yeah, that's all I'll do.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. What would you recommend I do while I'm in Holland? I'm there for 2 days. In Amsterdam, like Rotterdam. Give me tips for Rotterdam and then tips for Amsterdam.
Tips for Rotterdam. There's great comedy clubs in both. There's Club Hoog in Rotterdam, Tumelo Comedy Cafe in Amsterdam. In Amsterdam, it's not a fun thing to do, but there's a very nice new Holocaust museum.
Right. Okay.
But it's really well done. Just walk around, see the city, do a walking tour with a proper guide. That's much more fun than all the touristy stuff.
Yes. I did the canal tour last time. It was wonderful.
And in Rotterdam, they've got the water taxis that'll take you around town by water.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed it. What I loved most the last time, I did the kind of the water tour around Amsterdam, and the guy we had just couldn't give a shit. It was fantastic. Like, do you know what I mean? It was just like, oh yeah, over there, there's some buildings. He was just kind of like moving on. There was no detail. I think we managed to get a guy who was about to hand in his notice. It was absolutely wonderful. He would just go, yeah, there you go. That's a house. People live in houses. Like, it was so wonderful. It was like, there was no...
Imagine doing that for a living.
Yeah, well, this is it. And I think he checked out that day. But it was pretty special. And I spoke about it at the gig that night just because I'd never seen anybody commit less. It was wonderful. So I need to do that again just to see if it was him.
Yeah, there's even a group of comics doing tours.
Really?
Boat tours. Those damn boat guys.
Oh, really?
Because probably they had a similar experience and thought, we can do this better.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. That's quite a good idea, actually.
Yeah. But let's go back to the worst and shittiest gigs, because now you're a massive act doing arenas in great lovely halls. Obviously, you started out just playing small rooms as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And I came across an old article somewhere that said your first 5 gigs went really well, and then came gig number 6. I believe it was in Bristol.
That's right, yes. It was at a club.
What happened?
I don't really know what happened. The first 5 gigs were great, so I was really confident. And I kind of went on stage and just ate shit. It just, you know what it's like. It just didn't happen. I was 18 years old and I had my 5 minutes of material in my head and it just crumbled beneath me. And after a minute, I was gabbling and apologizing, and I kind of like left the stage after about 4 minutes, and I was on with a comedian called Scott Capurro. And
oh yeah, he's great.
Yeah. And I said to Scott, I was so just freaked out by it. I said, what do you do? Like, when a gig goes, what do you do when you have a gig like that? And Scott was like, I like to get a cock in my mouth as soon as I can. And I was like, all right, yeah. Are there other ways to get around it? Like, and he was like, it works for me. And I was like, yeah, but I don't know. So, yeah, it was doubly wonderful for that. It was for his advice. And I didn't do that, you know, but I got over the gig. Maybe I would have got over the gig quicker if I'd have sucked someone's cock. But it's so interesting, isn't it? Because the next day I remember thinking, right, I have to work a bit harder to make sure that never happens again. But in the the first time you die, particularly like 18, or, and I looked like 12, I just had all of my, like the status and all of you just crumbles, because you think it might all have been a just complete fluke that the first five worked, you know? But luckily, gig number 7 went well. I think if it hadn't gone well, I think that would have been it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, I just think, I think if, or I certainly would have had a break. Do you know what I mean? Like, I know a lot of my friends that have, on very, very early on, that died on their first gig, and they had to have a big gap before they did it again, or they had like a, you know, those kind of formative experiences. But I was quite lucky, really, that by the time it went really badly again, I was probably like, I don't know, 25 gigs in. So I felt, yeah, do you know what I mean? I was beginning to get a bit of a, of like muscle memory, I guess. But that first death, particularly being so young, and I got ID'd to get into the club as well. So it was, do you know what I mean? Like the whole night was, it was a tough night, and it was a tough gig.
Because that's something that keeps amazing me. I've talked to about 250 Dutch comedians and Flemish comedians, and everyone dies every now and again or has a very bad gig. And as bad as they get, everyone gets back on it pretty quick. Or even turns up at a gig thinking, this is going to be shit, and still goes on.
Yeah. It's really, well, you know, I guess that's being like a comedy holic, isn't it? It's sort of that thing where you're just like, the booze won't affect me. Do you know what I mean? It's that weird thing of like, you're sort of like, your liver's broke and you're there and you're just looking at this kind of like old bottle of wine and you're like, I'll be able to drink it. It's sort of that thing as well. Or it's like a horse that loads of cowboys won't jump on and you're like, yeah, fuck off. Jesus Christ, get, do you know what I mean? It's like, it's insane, man. I don't know what it is, but it's that weird, it's bungee jumping and buckarooing and an ego all kind of blended together that you're, because those gigs, when you do crack them, are electric as well, you know?
I tend to think that's the thing, that everyone thinks, oh, everyone's gone shit, but I can do this. I've got the magic twist to make it work.
Yeah, and sometimes you do, and sometimes you do, but you don't. But what's interesting, the further you get into it, like the times that I, like very often when I have sort of, you know, okay sets, it's when I'm trying out new stuff. So it's kind of a different experience because it's a bit more subjective, because you're like, ah, bugger, that doesn't quite work. But they still trust you. Do you know what I mean? But you're sort of going, is that a thing? Okay, fair enough. So it becomes a little bit more, I don't know, outer body experience, because it isn't like when you were on the circuit and you needed every gig. You're just kind of rocking up with a piece of paper and you kind of like, hey, what about this? Is this, you know, and then some bits really work. And those gigs, some of them are kind of deaths, but they're really exciting because you're kind of formulating something on stage. Do you know what I mean? And that's the other weird thing. The further you get into comedy, you know, you get loads of big comics that just love, not necessarily love death, but love the moments where it's kind of on a knife edge, you know. And if they really love you beforehand and you've managed to do something when they're a bit unsure, very often there's something quite exciting about that. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I'm not sure, because I'm not that big of a comic. But could that possibly have to do with, you know, this tour you're doing next month? Is a very big tour and you're famous all over the world. So if you do one of your shows, everyone knows you're and excited. Oh my God, we're going to see Russell Howard tonight.
Yes.
And if you're doing new material and it might not work straight away, that you get that feeling of being back on the circuit again.
Yeah, but
of taking a risk.
Yeah, but you kind of, I try and take all my risks at gigs where I'm not getting paid. Do you know what I mean? And then when I'm getting paid, I kind of, you know, I have stuff that I know will work. But then also, I love improvising in gigs. So that's, you can improvise in big gigs as well. It's great. you know, and then that's when it feels really kind of electric, if you're kind of improvising and mixing it in with your material. But this is, you know, primarily gigging in the UK and gigging in Australia and America. It's relatively safe ground. Do you know what I mean? I think if I was a Russian comedian, I'd probably, you know, like that must be a hard gig. It makes me laugh when you see American comics talking about freedom of speech and you're like, yeah, go to America, go to Russia, have a go at Putin and see how fucking edgy you are. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, because you'll be dead or you'll end up in prison. But
yeah, go to Thailand, do some jokes about the king.
Yeah,
I love it.
But exactly. It's so, yeah, it's almost like they don't view other countries in the world.
And do you remember gigs probably from the old days or maybe even recent where you showed up, looked around and thought, oh my God, this is going to be a tough gig?
Yeah, I had loads during COVID, but COVID changed everything, didn't it? Because suddenly, you know, because there were no gigs, when gigs started happening again and they were outside, you were saying yes to gigs like a year ago. I remember getting offered a gig in a car park and I was like, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, a year previously, there's no way I would have, but I did it. I did it 4 weeks in a row and it was, everyone was sat outside and there was, you know, big gaps. So they, you know, couldn't be near each other and all this. And on the basis of it, you look at it and go, this is, ordinarily, this is horrific. But because we have had no comedy for like a year, it was like, this is fucking amazing. Like it was, like we did a stadium gig because I wasn't allowed to do a theatre in Bristol, which was a 2,000 seater stadium. We figured out we could play Bristol City Stadium. So we put 2,000 people in a 25,000 seater stadium, right? And we had them on the corner. We had them on the corner there and they were all kind of spaced out. It was unbelievable. But because everyone's mindset was different. Do you know what I mean? So they were, the audience were like determined that this would work. And I was determined they would work and happy that I was there. But yeah, if you were to look at it and go 2,000 in a 25,000 seater, that's a tough gig, man.
That's a very tough gig.
It's all open air, but weirdly, it was all right. But when I was young, yeah, I had some, one of my favorite, and I've spoken about this before, but it's such an insane heckle. I did a Christmas show in Essex and a lady threw a dildo at me. And... and it hit me in the face. It was just, I find that so wonderful because it's like, it's her lack of faith in the evening. Do you know what I mean? That she, like, I've got my wallet, got my keys. Oh, I nearly forgot my dildo. And then the one thing that could bring her joy, she threw and like just launched it at me. And afterwards because I was emceeing, the headline act left the stage because somebody threw a sausage roll at him and the owner of the club was going, see, you're a professional. You got hit in the face with a dildo. He's walked because the sausage rolls hit him. And I was thinking, in my head, I'm going, oh, I'm skint and I desperately need the money. So for the dude being professional, it's like they could have done anything to me, but this is a Christmas gig. But Christmas gigs in England, I don't know if they're the same in the Netherlands, but my God, my friend Al Pitcher was doing a gig at Leicester Jonglers and a man...
And sorry to stop you there, but just explain what a Christmas gig is.
Oh, I see.
For people who don't know.
So a Christmas gig is any gig in December where normally it's work Christmas parties. So an ordinary comedy club is taken over by, you know... an IKEA party or a Tesco party or like big corporates. So big groups of 30 all getting pissed. And then there's three comics on and there you normally get paid double pay or time and a half to do them, but they are just brutal. And Al was on stage at Leicester Jonglers and somebody got a champagne bottle, right? And shot it at him. And the cork just whiz past him. But it's that thing where you go, it would have been the most decadent way of being blinded imaginable. Do you know what I mean? Of just like, but that's what I'm, that's, it's, but.
Imagine the two of you both blind, him by a cork and you by dildo.
By dildo, yeah, exactly. Yeah, just like really unlucky pirates just kind of meeting up. What happened to you?
Oh, yeah.
But it was, but again, they're both Christmas gigs, you know, goodwill to all men, but for whatever reason in England, they're just wild, man.
And then, and for some reason, well, money probably, you have to do them until a certain point in your career, I guess. But
yeah, well, that's it. It's like, that's when you know you kind of made it, when you don't have to do Christmas gigs in the UK. So they're, you know, when you're still doing them, those are the gigs still now. And I imagine there'll come a time when I have to do them again in the future, where you just look at the room and you're like, okay, right. Okay. Like, do you know what I mean? It's like, yikes. But I don't know what it is, because I really love Christmas and, you know, I kind of like a party, but yeah, there's something about those gigs or New Year's Eve gigs where people are so shit-faced that you just need the most, like if you've got any kind of shred of sort of creativity and desire to make something a little bit original, then those New Year's Eve, Christmas Eve gigs are, do you know what I mean? I remember there's a brilliant comic who used to have a routine. I remember doing Croydon up the creek with him, and he had a routine about the men that could turn him. He was a straight guy, and it was a routine about, you know, there's one, I guess, you know, and then he literally reeled off a list that went on for about 5 minutes or the bit, and that was the gag. And it was this kind of like almost George Carlin poetic list of names. Viggo Mortensen, David Beckham, you know, it's just like, just went on and on and on. And the reaction from the crowd, because I was at the top of the stairs watching all these kind of bald men going, well, I'm fucking off. And then just like, but like furious, do you know what I mean? Not saying anything, but like livid Pac-Man going, she's not how I want to celebrate my new party. It was absolutely exhilarating. It's the best walkout I've ever seen in my life.
Did you have to go on after him, or had you been on before?
Yeah, I've had that a lot, actually. I used to, I remember I was emceeing at the Edinburgh Festival, and a comedian had got involved in an altercation with somebody in the crowd. It was late in life, so it's a show that starts at 1 a.m. And I used to...
And that's a gig notorious for being rowdy. So
I loved it. I used to MC it when I was from like 23 to 26. I used to MC it every Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And it started at 1 and it went on till 3 a.m. And it was just all kind of like carnage and, you know, absolute some madness. What, you know, I remember there was a guy, he's a brilliant clown act called Chris Lynham, and he's fantastic, absolutely wild. He went on stage and big hair, you know, makeup everywhere, and he's got like 4 pineapples and he's smashing the pineapples with like a massive lump of wood, and then just turning to the crowd and go, there will be no juggling tonight, and then fucking getting chocolate and just rubbing it on people, just wild, and the crowd just booed him off, just completely, just so he lasted about 5 minutes, and then I had to come in afterwards and just went, I said, listen, you've really ruined that for yourselves, because he, at the end of the show, he was gonna, because I've seen him many times, he ended his show by putting a firework up his ass and singing There's No Business Like Show Business, and this bloke goes, this bloke in the audience shouted out, oh, why didn't he start with it? And you're like, mate, where the fuck do you go if you open by putting a firework on your ass, thinking there's no business like show business? So it became this sort of incredible moment of like us trying to imagine what he can possibly do to top it. But yeah, there was some great, anyways, so there was a comedian that was basically having a fight with someone in the front row, and it was like fisticuffs, all got a bit weird. And then this comic turned to the person in the audience and went, what was the line? He went, meet me in the car park and bring your fucking God. And it was like insane. It, like, you know, they were going to meet in the car park and fight.
Yeah, yeah.
And my job at the end of Late in Life was to introduce a band. And, you know, the band that night were a reggae band. And it was just so funny. Like, people were throwing glasses. It was insane. And I had to walk on stage and go, does anyone like reggae? And it was it was so funny, because in the middle of all this kind of like violence and intensity, like playing the role of like a sort of nervous entertainer, fuck, it was brilliant. So we had to, it, you know, those gigs, they were so, you, the whole point of them was that you could never really do material. So they were like, but nobody was recording it as well. It was so like in the room and, you know, 1 a.m. until 3 a.m. It was counterculture and mad. They were fucking brilliant.
Hi, this is Wouter. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you do, then hit like or leave a comment if your podcast app lets you do that kind of thing. Or even better, tell your friends and share a link to this episode on your social media. I run this podcast entirely on my own, and your help means a lot. In the description of this episode, you will find links to other episodes I've done in English. Okay, let's get back to Russell.
But still, if you're sat there and you see the fight going on and you know I'm about to walk on stage again in 5 minutes, I'm sure afterwards you say, oh, this was brilliant and you had a great night. But you must have had moments where you think, oh, God, can I just leave and let them fight among themselves?
Yeah, no, I don't know. Like, I sort of, again, it goes back to that madness of going, oh, we're going to win them back. You know what I mean? It was like, this is unplayable. But I specifically remember being excited because I remember thinking, it's going to be so funny that in the middle of this kind of like a scene from Trainspotting, I have to introduce a reggae band. Like that, I'm like, yeah. You know what I mean? I was so convinced it was funny that I was excited by that sort of performance juxtaposition idea. I don't know, I just was like, oh fuck, how funny is this? I've got to go on and introduce a fucking reggae band. And then everyone was like, oh, that's, you know what I mean? So it kind of,
yeah.
I don't know, the energy of it propelled me forward.
Yeah. And speaking of introductions, one thing that's never ceases to amaze me is charity gigs where right before the comedy starts, they decide to have a very long presentation or PowerPoint with very sick children, tubes out of noses. Yep. Have you done those?
Yeah, yeah. And it's. I'm luckily now I'm sort of at that stage where you can say, can you do it at the beginning of the night before it all starts? And then, you know, and then have 10 minutes of music to kind of get it back. Or I find if
put
you
on
do,
a reggae band.
If on a reggae band, or put it on just before the interval is normally the best bit, because then kind of people then see it. But yeah, I mean, I've had that where you just kind of go on after that. It's just like, where do you go other than kind of acknowledge it and then go, you know, wow, that's the only way, you know, to try and sort of acknowledge how heavy it is and then explain how peculiar it is that you have to then be funny. It then, it's sort of that Bill Hicks line, isn't it? It's that thing about keeping your third eye. And it's like, if in that moment you can realize how insane it is, the worst thing you could do is just go out and do your stuff.
Oh yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like if you've just seen like, let's say you're doing a donkey sanctuary and you've just seen a video of like a man kidnapping a donkey and beating that donkey to death. And if you kind of came on and went, you know, I don't know if you've flown recently, like you have to acknowledge the kind of weirdness and say, listen, that's not me, by the way. I know that looked a bit, or whatever. Do you know what I mean? You know. And
have you had weird introductions yourself?
Yeah, yeah, many. I'm trying to think of like the strangest introduction probably was from Patrick Stewart, who from Star Trek.
The actor, yeah.
So at the Montreal Comedy Festival, what they used to do, they used to get celebrities and they'd get writers to give them jokes. And then the celebrities would host the gala. And then you'd have comics, you know, doing 7 minutes each, and it was hosted by a celebrity. And clearly, the writers working for Patrick Stewart realized pretty early on that he'd be up for saying pretty much anything. Because his opening line was, "I'm very much in favor of assisted suicide because I find when I put my hands around the neck of a dying woman, it's the only way I can get hard." And the whole, that was his opening line. He didn't say, didn't even say hello. And the whole room were like, "What the fuck is that Patrick?" And everyone looked over at the writers, who looked so sheepish. And Gina Yashere turned to me and was like, "Fuck's sake, they wouldn't let me say moist." Because all the lawyers had to check every word you said, and it became apparent that Patrick Stewart's writers had taken all the filthy words and he was using them. But the way he introduced me, I was doing a tour called Wonderbox at the time, and he went, "This young man is currently doing a tour called Wonderbox. That's what I call my wife's pussy," like that. And it, like, as with everything he did that night, it died. So I then have to go on and go, I was like, "What is going on with that cat, man? It feels like," and I think I was like, basically, like Dignitas had told him that they were coming for him, and he was like, "Well, fuck you. This is like it." It was almost like a bucket list where he wanted to see what he could say, if he could say the maddest stuff. But yeah, that was pretty strange. But having the mental thing is, they cut out the celebrities from the TV recording. So if you watch the Montreal comedy special I'm on, every single comic starts their set by going, "Hello," like that. So it's just,
yeah,
it just looks like, because they're all reacting to go, "What the fuck was, hi, hello." But so
that must be a real mindfuck, because as you said, you know, with the charities, you have to acknowledge, "Ooh, we just saw this movie of a guy with a donkey." You can't say anything about it because he's going to be cut out.
Totally. Yeah. Well, that was it. Yeah. So, but oddly, it's kind of, yeah, it really stayed with me. It was so funny, man. It's one of my favorite gigs of all time, because he was just, honestly, he died so hard all night. And it was just all these kind of, like, do you know what I mean? Like, edgy young writers. And they just, they must have got such a bollocking the next day, because they're given, because the crowd were like, you know, like really like mainstream, like, "Oh my God, it's Patrick Stewart from Star Trek. I'm so excited. Hopefully he'll make some references to Spock and some." And he was just like literally going, "Yeah, and I'm going to choke her and get hard." And it was just fucking mental.
He probably rhymed with Spock.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, that's at least, if he'd have done like a Vulcan death move on his penis, that would have been vaguely Star Trek-y. But he didn't even have that. It was hilarious. That would have made sense if he literally came on and go, "I tell you, fam, wanking hard, my buddy Spock." Every time he, you know, at least there's something where you can kind of go, "Oh, okay." But for him to come out and say he wants to strangle a woman because it's the only way he can get hard, without even saying hello, it's like, what? He's fucking mad. It's like 3,000 people, man. It was so fucking crazy.
Did you speak to him afterwards?
No. He was sort of away from everybody. I think he thought it had gone really well, but it was so funny. It was, but like I say, that's, they don't really do it at Montreal anymore. They now kind of just get like big comics to host it, like Trevor Noah or something like that. But yeah, it was pretty exciting, but you know, pretty weird.
Do you remember the last time you died on your ass like that? I assume it's pretty long time ago, but...
I did a... Probably... Just doing new material at a little gig in Bristol. And just one of those. I wrote a load of stuff. I thought it was really funny. And there was probably about 20 people there. It was a really small gig, and just kind of like a lot of that, you know. I just couldn't, and it was, yeah, it was weird. I just couldn't quite get through the ideas. I can't even remember what the stuff was about, but it was just, And then the funny thing is, I then went to another gig and the stuff went really well. And you're like, okay. Do you know what I mean? It was like one of those. But the idea that there would have been, you know, 100 people walking that way and 20 people walking that way and 100 going, oh, it's really funny. And it was new. It was kind of interesting. Like, oh my God, that guy, fuck. It was just, do you know what I mean? And it's like, that's the madness of stand-up, isn't it? We've all had those nights where, you know, some people think it's genius and some people are just horrified, you know?
Yeah. And does it still scare you in a way if that happens?
I don't enjoy dying. I'm like very much, I want all of it to work and I want people to love me. That's why I do stand up. So I can't like lean into it. I don't have that. But I don't know if it necessarily scares me. It's just that it's just part of the process now. It's just kind of, you sort of know how it's going to feel. If it goes badly, if the stuff doesn't work, you're like, okay, I'm going to have to fix it. Do you know what I mean? It's more that now that you've been doing it for so long rather than that existential, oh my God, can I ever do this again? Do you know what I mean? It's kind of, I normally just, if I've had a real stinker, I'll kind of like call up a mate or speak to my wife and then the next morning you're like, and relax. But yeah, I remember doing a gig when I was young. One of the weirdest gigs is in a place called Eastbourne. It's probably about 20. And this guy interrupted my set by going, have you been fucking my wife? And I was like, what? No, hey, you know?
That's a weird heckle.
Yeah, very specific. And I was like, no. And he sort of like stormed the stage and like tried to hit me on that. And I was still holding on to the mic, kind of, you know, ducking it. And then he kind of just stormed out. Was like, leave my fucking wife alone. I was like, what? And it was only like this little small gig. And I was just like, nobody tried to help me. I was just stood there going, okay, what was, oh, well. And then this woman kind of walked out and I was like, you're right. Who are you? And she's like, I'm his wife. I was like, well, why didn't you say that we haven't been having sex? And she's like, I would never fuck you. I was like, I don't, what? Like, it was this weird thing of like, she's like, you're not even worth it. I'm like, I never said I was. Well, like, what? Like, it was the most insane gig. And then the owner of the gig rang up my agents and just went, just let Russell know that the bouncers saw that guy in the kebab house at the end of the night and they beat the fuck out of him. And this is the line. He goes, so all's well that ends well. And you're like, the worst. But it's the idea that those bouncers, like clearly they wanted to beat him up. I refuse to believe that those bouncers were like, let's go beat him up in the name of art. Like, it's just, you know what I mean? That smells like a fucking alibi. Like they're like, you know. But yeah, that was pretty strange.
Well, I read an article that where it happened more or less the other way around, where you cut a gig short, summer 2020. What happened?
Well, I had brand new stuff, and there was a woman in the front. Like, there was again probably 20 people there. It was kind of COVID, just out of COVID time, and I was sat on a stool. And I was just doing a gig as a favor for my friend. It's like a new material night. And I started chatting and she kind of got her phone out and like literally had the phone like there, kind of like properly really
up
in my
your face.
Yeah. I was kind of going, and I was like, don't do that. And she's like, just carry on. And I was like, no, put the phone away. And she was like, well, why being like that? It's my right. And I just lost my temper.
Did you really say it's my right?
Yeah. And I was just kind of like, she's like, you're the performer, perform. And it was that, you're the performer for, exactly. So then I'm like,
dance monkey.
Not now, I'm fucking not. So I literally just went, well, I'm sorry, everyone else, but I simply cannot even attempt to entertain you, madam, because it would kill me. And I walked off. And then it made it to the papers and it was in the press and it was quite a big story in the UK, and there were even like opinion pieces of like, did Russell do the right thing in that? You know, when you just go,
yes,
ask any comic, ask any comic, and all of them were like, yeah, of course. like that, like none of them would have carried on, or they would have, they certainly wouldn't have just carried on and done their stuff. You know what I mean? It was like, it was this weird, there was an article that sort of said, you know, comedy's struggling and comedians should just do it for the audience. And you're like, no. Like, it's not, you know, and it's, and also because it was brand new, it was like, it's not finished. That, you know, there'll come a time when it gets recorded, hopefully, but there has to be a space where you can just go and fail. But as soon as, if somebody records it, then it's tangible, and that's it. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's like, that's what he said, and he means that forever. And it was just the, I was so reluctant. I just couldn't relax. And I just thought, oh, there's no point. Do you know what I mean? So I sort of just walked off, and then, yeah, it was like all over the newspapers. So weird. You did the right, you know, when you know you've done the right thing.
Yeah, absolutely. But,
you know, yeah.
I don't understand why people don't ask the question, should you, are you allowed to film during comedy or any performance?
But I think also what's noticeable about that is that that's definitely a generational thing, because it's someone of my age, you know, an old man like me, I would never want to spoil the poise of the performer by going like that, you know. But I think, you know, younger people, it's just part of it. And I would never just text in the front row.
Oh, no.
If a comedian, but again, it's that thing. It's not, they're so used to multi-screening. It's like, you're just another thing in the corner. So I don't know. It's slightly, if you're doing a comedy club, I'm sort of slightly like now, like, wow, the world is so different now. If they're going like that, it's probably because they want to go, hey, look who I saw. And it's not the end of the world, but
a quick picture is something totally different than filming.
Yeah, well, that's it. It was because it was there and I could see it, and it just, it was properly awkward, man.
Yeah. I fully understand. I once had a woman in the audience who was live streaming it, the show on Facebook.
Oh, my God.
I said, well, can you not do that? Yeah, but it's good for you. You'll reach a bigger crowd. Was it?
Yeah, no. Exactly.
Call your friends, tell them to come over. That's fine.
Yeah, exactly. It's when it's bent that way that that's when you kind of flip a bit and you're like, nah. You're like, come on, it'll be good for you. Come on. And you're like, it just riles you up. You know what I mean? And it was like, nah.
But even without the phone out filming it, if someone were to say to you, you're the performer, perform.
Yeah, exactly.
That's good enough a reason to walk out, isn't it?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Well, it's like that great story of Larry David, isn't it? That I think he famously, when he was doing stand-up, he kind of walked out one night, just looked at the audience, went, nah. And just kind of went home. But
wish I had the balls to do that.
Yeah, but again, it's that thing, isn't it, that sometimes the way I look at it, it's kind of like they're like those gigs, every gig is just hours in the gym. That's what it is. It's just that thing of just keeping going. And even if a gig's a little bit sticky or they're a little bit tight, you know, it's like if you can try and relax, you'll make future gigs better by just trying to have fun and then see if you can find. I think whenever you find new ground, then any gig has the potential to be good because you're trying to entertain yourself. Do you know what I mean? I think the hardest gigs sometimes are when the audience is a bit stiff and you're just doing your best stuff, because the noise you're hearing isn't the noise that you normally hear from that stuff. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you've got like a new idea, you're kind of okay because you're like, you've got nothing to compare it with. Do you know what I mean? So I kind of find that sort of helps a bit. Like whenever it's a bit stiff, it's like, ah, fuck it. Let's see if we can sort of mix it up.
I love that approach rather than doing because you always do and not, yeah.
Yeah, but because you'll become the comedian, you'll become the person you were before you were the comedian. Do you know what I mean? Like that you're just so desperate to entertain them. That's normally my approach.
Yeah. Great. Last thing I wanted to ask you about, because I listened to the Comedians Comedian podcast with Stuart Goldsmith.
Yeah.
And you mentioned your opening act when you did Wembley, Steve Hall. He was rather frightened, I guess, by the
It was at the Royal Albert Hall, and my tour manager Kumar tapped him on the back to wish him luck, and he vomited everywhere. But he also vomited at Wembley, actually, because there's a gantry that kind of goes up as you walk on stage at Wembley Arena, and he vomited off that as well. So there's a real theme,
right before the show.
Right before, proper white hot nerves. And both times the gigs were fine, but it was that weird, he needed to purge. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of that thing of, I remember weirdly, when I first started, I remember the first, I'd say probably the first, I hadn't even thought about this, but I think the first 20 gigs I did, I made myself sick before I kind of went up. Yeah, weird, eh? I hadn't thought about this for a long time. But it was that thing of, I wanted to be empty before I went on somehow. Like, do you know what I mean? And then I kind of like got over it, but it became this weird, and I think Steve had a bit of that. It was a bit of like a weird ritual. It's like, if you're being sick, you don't have to worry about being scared. And this is me thinking about what he might have done. He might have just had some bad food. But I think it was very much a purging. And then both days, the gigs were great. He did fantastic. But I wonder if there are other comics like that had these weird sort of patterns before they started. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't really drink. And then I do drink now. But when I was young, I wasn't really a particularly big drinker. But I always used to have 2 pints before I would go on for like the first, I don't know, I would say definitely the first 15 gigs. And then you suddenly just were like, why am I doing this? I would never, but it was this kind of, it became, the first time I did it, I had 2 pints, then I did the gig just to calm me down. And then it was like, well, what I have to do before the gig is have to,
exactly.
You know what I mean? And it became this weird kind of ritual. What were you going to say? Sorry.
Well, I wanted to say I was in a band before I started doing comedy, and we'd play drunk more often than sober. And when I started doing comedy, I decided I'm not going to drink before a show because of that, because I didn't want to have, the tradition of I have to drink, otherwise I can't perform well.
Yeah.
But
yeah, totally.
You said you made yourself sick. Not even out of nerves or anything, just fingers down your throat.
Desire to be empty, like weirdly. But again, it became this weird thing of going, right, the first time I did the show, first of a gig, I made myself sick and it was fine. And then, I should do that now. That's something I do. And then, again, after 15 gigs, like, this is ridiculous. I'm gonna hurt myself. But it's that, I'd be amazed if there aren't comedians with weird kind of habits and patterns, and singers. Singers as well, Christ alive, but there's all sorts.
I know of a lot that vomit. I know of a Dutch famous singer who still, up to this day, and I think he's about 70 now, allegedly has a bucket on the side of the stage.
Really?
And a Dutch comedian who's passed away last year, unfortunately. But when he started out, he'd bring his own little bucket in case there wasn't one backstage.
Wow. And was he ever sick?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because they were the comedians that started doing stand-up in, the form you all know, in Holland. And when they started out, one of them was on the show and he said, I was performing in his very small bar. We were in front of the toilets and I could hear him in the toilet behind me being sick because he had to go on after him.
Wow. God, that's so... And was he a good comic?
Yeah, he was fantastic.
Wow. Amazing,
but
eh?
Very nervous and very insecure, but very, very funny.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. That's the same as Steve Hall. There was no need for him to be sick, but it was just this... You know what I mean? And then
it like literally as his name was being called on stage.
And then he did great. The only people that suffer are me and Kumar because we're kind of trying to watch it. We're kind of surrounded by his sick because it was the like vantage point to watch the gig. But yeah.
That takes the glamour away of showbiz. Being over a puddle of sick.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, Wembley Arena stinks. fucking brilliant. Well, I really enjoyed that, man. Nice to
Thanks a lot. And I'm very happy you grew over that because this tour would have been horrible if you had to be sick every night.
Brutal. Yeah, there's no sick no more. All good. No. All right, man. Take care, bud.
Thanks a lot.
That was it. The Elektra Podcast with Russell Howard. If you enjoyed it, please hit like or leave a comment if you can, and or share this show with all your friends. Check out the links to other English episodes in the description, and you will also find links to Russell's website, all his tour information, and where to get your tickets. If you want to know more about me, Wouter Monde, go to woutermonde.nl and go to elektrapodcast.nl to find out more about this podcast. It will be in Dutch, though. Okay, until the next Elektra. Bye.